Part 4, Byzantium and the Slavs. Of all the achievements of the Byzantines, none is so remarkable as their impact on the Slavic world. Here we are dealing with the transfer of a civilization, substantially unmodified, from a more advanced to a less advanced group of peoples. Much as old Rome civilized and eventually Christianized large groups of barbarians in Western Europe, so Constantinople, the New Rome, civilized and Christianized the Slavs. Many of the problems that beset the West today in its dealings with the Soviet Union and Russia arise from the fact that the Soviet Union, or Russia, is first and foremost Russia, a country in the Orthodox and not in the Western Christian tradition, a country that still shows the effects of having experienced its conversion from Byzantium. The first of the Slavic peoples to fall under Byzantine influence were the Bulgarians, who were the product of a fusion between a Slavic population and a smaller group of Asiatic Bulgar invaders. From the time these barbarians crossed the Danube in the late 7th century, they engaged in intermittent warfare against the Byzantine Empire. In 811, the ruler of the Bulgarians, Krum, defeated the imperial forces, and the emperor Nicephorus I was killed, the first emperor to fall in battle since the death of Valens at Adrianople in 378. Krum took the skull of Nicephorus, had it hollowed out and lined with silver, and used it as a drinking cup, behavior that vividly shows the level of Bulgarian civilization at the time. Bulgarian religion was primitive. The sun and moon and stars were worshipped and propitiated with sacrifices of horses and dogs. The overwhelming masses of the people were peasants living in huts. Yet the rulers of this people had created a powerful state, which by the middle of the 9th century had reached the stage all barbarian tribes eventually reached: preparedness for conversion, for the reception of the religion that alone could accompany a position of prestige in the medieval world. Already, Greek artisans were imported into Bulgaria to build the palaces of the native rulers. Since there was no Bulgarian alphabet, Greek letters had to be used in the royal inscriptions. Yet the Bulgarian rulers hesitated to accept missionaries from Byzantium, since this would surely mean the extension of Byzantine political power. At the same time, a Slavic people called the Moravians, who lived far to the west in what is now Czechoslovakia, had also established a powerful state of their own and had reached a stage similar to that reached by the Bulgarians. Their rulers felt themselves ready for Christianity, but just as the Bulgarians associated the religion with their powerful neighbors, the Byzantines, and feared Byzantine imperial political encroachment, so the Moravians associated it with their powerful neighbors, the Germans, and feared both German and papal encroachment. In 862, the king of the Moravians began the process that was to culminate in the conversion of the Slavs. He sent to Byzantium, in order to avoid German or papal influence, and asked that a Greek missionary be sent to teach the Moravian people Christianity in their own Slavic language. The Byzantine emperor, Michael III, sent to Moravia two missionaries, Cyril, or Constantine, and his brother Methodius, called the Apostles to the Slavs. They knew the Slavic tongue, and had invented an alphabet in which it could be written. This is the alphabet still in use to this day by the Russians, the Bulgarians, and the Serbs, and still called Cyrillic, after its inventor. Almost at once, as a countermove, Boris, ruler of the Bulgarians, asked for Christianity from the Germans. But these efforts on the part of the two Slavic rulers to avoid accepting conversion at the hands of their powerful neighbors and to obtain it instead from a less threatening distant court were doomed to failure. In spite of the efforts of Cyril and Methodius among the Moravians, German pressure and eventual papal reluctance to give final sanction to the conduct of church services outside the Latin tongue proved too strong. After some years, it was the German clergy and the Roman form of Christianity that triumphed in Moravia. Similarly, despite Boris's negotiations with the Germans and a long correspondence with the popes, during which the Roman pontiff on one occasion gave him advice about wearing trousers, permissible, and eating all his meals by himself, permissible but rude, the nearby power of Byzantium was too strong, and Roman Christianity had to yield. At first, the Byzantines forced their faith on Boris by the sword. Boris yielded, but the flood of Greek priests that followed, and the Byzantine attempts to prescribe the proper duties of the Christian prince, annoyed him, and he turned to Rome. His flirtation with the papacy, however, ended in disillusionment when it became clear that Rome would not allow him to have an independent church of his own. He moved back to the Byzantine church, and this time the Byzantines did not repeat their mistakes. They permitted the Bulgarians virtual ecclesiastical autonomy. Only in the fold of the Eastern Church could Boris unify his country and consolidate his own autocratic power. The Byzantine Patriarch, unlike the Pope, made no temporal claims. In Bulgaria, then, from the late 9th century on, the language of the Church was the native Slavonic tongue preached by followers of Cyril and Methodius. Of course, the conversion of Bulgaria did not mean that an era of perpetual good relations was now established between Byzantium and the new converts. The ambitions of the Bulgarian rulers were too great for that. Under Simeon, 889 to 927, second son of Boris, himself educated in Constantinople and called half-Greek by his contemporaries, there began a bitter 100 years war, during which the Bulgarians tried to make themselves emperors by conquering Constantinople itself. Toward the end of the 10th century, the rivalry became more intense than ever under a Bulgarian ruler named Samuel. In 1014, Basil II, 976 to 1025, captured 14,000 or 15,000 Bulgarian prisoners and savagely blinded 99 out of every 100. The 100th man was allowed to keep the sight of one eye so that he could lead his miserable fellows home. At the ghastly sight of his blinded warriors, Samuel fell dead of shock. Basil II took the appropriate name of Bulgar Slayer. Shortly afterward, Byzantine domination over Bulgaria became complete, and the country was ruled as a conquered province. But its inhabitants were never deprived of their own church, whose archbishop had just as much jurisdiction as he had had in the days of Bulgarian independence. The great expenditures of money and manpower incidental to the long pursuit of the Bulgarian War played their part in weakening Byzantium for the military disasters that were to come at Manzikert and at Bari. But Boris's decision to accept Christianity from Constantinople and the subsequent Byzantine military conquest of his country helped to determine where the line between East and West would be drawn for all future history. The Bulgarians are an Orthodox people to this day, and their architecture, their literature, and their art throughout the Middle Ages directly reflected the overpowering influence of Byzantium. In much the same way, more than 300 years later, the western neighbors of the Bulgarians, the Serbs, also took their faith from the Greek East after a flirtation with the Latin West, and the Serbs acted for the same reason, the attractions of Byzantium. To the north and east of the Balkan Bulgarians lie the great plains between the Baltic and the Black Seas, the plains of European Russia. Here, movement is easiest by water along the valleys of the rivers that flow north into the Baltic or south into the Black or Caspian Seas. Beginning in the 8th century, the Scandinavians, whom we have already encountered in their invasions of England and of Western Europe, expanded into Russia also. Thus taking control of the Baltic shore, they then began to move south along the rivers to the Sea of Azov and the northern Caucasus. Their name, in the period of expansion, was Rus, which has survived in the modern term Russia. Gradually they overcame many of the Slavic, Lithuanian, Finnish, and Magyar peoples who were then living on the steppe. The details of this process are very little known. The story told in the old Russian primary chronicle, compiled during the 11th century, is suggestive of what may have happened among the inhabitants of Russia sometime in the 850s. There was no law among them, but tribe rose against tribe. Discord thus ensued among them, and they, the native peoples, began to war against one another. They said to themselves, "Let us seek a prince who may rule over us and judge us according to the law." They accordingly went overseas to the Varangian Rusis and said to the people of Rus, "Our whole land is great and rich, but there is no order in it. Come to rule and reign over us." This is the story of the calling of the princes. The chronicle goes on to tell how Rurik, who has now been successfully identified with a Danish warrior known from other sources, accepted the invitation and settled in the town of Novgorod, already an important trading center. From Novgorod, within a few years, Scandinavian princes moved south along the Dnieper River. On the middle course of the Dnieper, they seized the settlement called Kiev, still today the major city of the Ukraine, and made it the center of a state at first very loosely controlled and devoted especially to trade. And in 860, for the first time, a fleet of 200 of their warships appeared off Constantinople, where they at first caused panic, but were eventually repulsed. During the next 2 centuries, there were 3 further attacks of varying seriousness, as well as other wars, which the Byzantines won. But the normal state of affairs was not war between Byzantium and Russia. The texts of the trade treaties concluded between the two reflect close economic ties. We find the Byzantines promising to feed the visiting Russian traders and to furnish them baths and supplies for the homeward voyage. The Russians agreed to live in a special quarter outside the city during their stay in Constantinople and to be registered by imperial officials. They shall not enter the city save through 1 gate, unarmed and 50 at a time, escorted by soldiers of the emperor. This shows how anxious the Byzantines were to protect the lives and property of their citizens from the wild barbarians. At the same time, they were eager to obtain the merchandise that the Russians brought them. Most important, however, was the continuing religious influence that Byzantium exercised upon the Russians. No doubt numerous individual Russians were converted from their primitive polytheistic faith simply as a result of their impressions during a visit to Byzantium. In the Trade Treaty of 945, we find that some of the Russian envoys are already Christians and are already swearing by the Holy Cross to observe the provisions of the treaty. In the 950s, Olga, the ruling princess of Kiev, visited the emperor at Constantinople. Olga came before him, and when he saw that she was very fair of countenance and wise as well, the emperor wondered at her intellect. He conversed with her and remarked that she was worthy to reign with him in his city. When Olga heard these words, she replied that she was still a pagan, and that if he desired to baptize her, he should perform this function himself. Otherwise, she was unwilling to accept baptism. The emperor, with the assistance of the patriarch, accordingly baptized her. After her baptism, the emperor summoned Olga and made known to her that he wished her to become his wife. But she replied, "How can you marry me after baptizing me yourself and calling me your daughter? For among Christians, that is unlawful, as you must know." Then the emperor said, "Olga, you have outwitted me." The Russians were converted as a people during the late 980s in the reign of Vladimir. He felt the inadequacy of the old faith, about which we do not know very much except that the Russians worshipped forest and water spirits and a god of thunder. According to the partly legendary story in the Chronicle, Vladimir was visited by representatives of the different faiths, who told him about their beliefs. He discarded the faith of Mohammed because circumcision and abstinence from pork and wine were disagreeable to him. "Drinking," said he, "is the joy of the Russes. We cannot exist without that pleasure." Judaism he rejected because the God of the Jews had not been strong enough to enable them to stay in their native Jerusalem. Roman Christianity he rejected because it required a certain amount of fasting, as, of course, did the Christianity of the Greeks. But the cautious Vladimir did not accept this fourth possibility, Orthodox Christianity, until he had sent a commission to visit the countries where all the faiths were practiced and to report back to him. The envoys reported, "When we journeyed among the Muslims, we beheld how they worship in a mosque, and there is no happiness among them, but only sorrow and a dreadful stench. Their religion is not good. Then we went among the Germans, and we saw them performing many ceremonies in their temples, but beheld no glory there. Then we went on to Greece, and the Greeks led us to the edifices where they worshipped their God, and we knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. For on earth there is no such splendor or such beauty, and we are at a loss to describe it. We only know that God dwells there among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations, for we cannot forget that beauty." Shortly afterward, Vladimir was baptized and married a Byzantine princess. Returning to Kiev, he threw down all the idols in the city, and in one day forcibly baptized the entire population in the waters of the Dnieper. Despite its legendary features, the whole story reflects the various cultural influences to which the Kievan state was in truth exposed. It had Muslim, Jewish, and Roman and Greek Christian neighbors, but the most powerful and influential neighbor was Byzantium, and doubtless the marriage alliance with the Byzantine princess and the resulting gain in prestige played a part in Vladimir's decision. To secure the conversion of the Russians to the Byzantine form of Christianity was also important for the Byzantines, who needed to protect their possessions along the Black Sea and their capital itself against Russian attack. To the Russians, conversion meant great changes in their way of life. The church became an important social force in Kievan society, and the clergy formed an entirely new and highly influential social class. In spite of the fact that the Byzantines always asserted theoretical sovereignty over the Russian church, and in spite of the fact that the archbishops of Kiev in the early period were mostly Greeks and appointed from Byzantium, the Russian church quite early asserted its practical independence. The church in Russia from the first became an important landowner, and as in the Byzantine Empire, monasteries multiplied. The clergy came to have jurisdiction over all Christians in cases involving morals, family affairs, and religious matters. A new and more advanced concept that crimes should be punished by the state replaced the old primitive feeling that punishment was a matter of personal revenge. For the first time, formal education was established. The Cyrillic alphabet was adopted, and literature in Russian began to appear, almost all of it ecclesiastical. Byzantine art forms were imported and imitated. The great church of Santa Sophia at Kiev is in its way as magnificent as its namesake in Constantinople. The old pagan faith persisted in the countryside. Enormous rural areas remained backward, and culture was largely confined to the few cities and to the monasteries. In the main, however, the conversion of the Russians had a civilizing effect. Yet the short-run gain may well have been outweighed by a long-run loss. the very use of the native language in the liturgy, which was so great an advantage to the Byzantines when, as missionaries, they sought to spread their faith without insisting on the use of their language, meant that the culture of Russia remained poor by contrast with that of the West. In the West, every priest and every monk had to learn Latin. As soon as he did so, he had the key to the treasures of Latin classical literature and the works of the Latin Church Fathers, who had themselves been formed in the schools of pagan rhetoric, philosophy, and literature. The educated man in the West, usually a cleric, had access to Virgil, to Ovid, to Cicero, and to a large number of lesser authors, some of whom may not have been in the least suitable for clerical reading, but all of whom gave the reader a sense of style, a familiarity with ancient taste and thought, and sometimes solid instruction. He had St. Jerome, who had gone to school to Cicero, and St. Augustine, whose City of God was the classic expression of Christian philosophy, written in magnificent Latin prose. The educated man in the West had a whole library of commentaries on the classic authors, designed to reconcile them with Christian doctrine, and to make it legitimate to study them, to teach them, and to copy them for posterity. Not every priest and monk in the West could qualify as a professor of classics, but for those who had the leisure, the talent, the inclination, and the luck to find themselves in a monastery with a good library, the opportunity for learning and cultivation was open. The fact that the Byzantines did not insist on the use of Greek in the liturgy meant that the Russian clergy did not automatically learn Greek, as French or English or German or Spanish priests had to learn Latin. A very few Russians did learn Greek, but by and large the great Greek classical heritage of philosophy and literature was not available to Russians. Sermons, saints' lives, some chronicles and history, and certain other pieces of Byzantine literature, including both Basil, Digenes, Acritus, and Barlaam and Eosuf, were indeed translated and circulated in Slavonic. But these, as we have seen, were hardly substitutes for Plato and Aristotle, Homer and the dramatists. The conversion to Christianity from Byzantium thus had the effect of stunting the intellectual and literary progress of Russia. It is clear, of course, that the Kievan Russians of the 10th century were not ready for Plato and Aristotle. But when a time in their development came when they would have been ready, they were cut off from access to the treasure house. Indeed, in the 19th century, a very influential group of Russian thinkers argued that conversion from Byzantium had led Russia into hopeless stagnation and wretched intellectual sterility, because it had cut Russia off from Rome, the fountainhead of the vigorous intellectual and spiritual life of the West, without providing a substitute. Their opponents argued just as vigorously that it was precisely the Orthodox faith accepted from Byzantium that gave modern Russia her high degree of spirituality, her willingness to bend to the will of God, and indeed all the virtues which they found in the Russian character and the Russian system. This difference of opinion persists, but it may be said without much fear of contradiction that modern Russia has shown a considerable cultural lag in comparison with Western countries, that this cultural lag is partly attributable in the first place to the fact that Christianity was accepted from Byzantium, and that the very privilege of using Slavonic in the church services prevented the growth in Russia of a class of men educated in the wisdom of the ancient world. It would be a grave mistake, however, to attribute the cultural lag solely to these factors. It was, perhaps, in even greater measure due to the effect on Russian development of the Tatar invasions and domination of the 13th and 14th centuries. Kievan Russia itself, in spite of whatever drawbacks conversion from Byzantium may have had, developed a society not very unlike that in contemporary Western medieval Europe. From being a mere Scandinavian war band, sworn to assist the prince in battle and entitled to divide the booty with him, the prince's entourage had now become that upper ruling group of counselors appropriate to a settled state. The Kievan law codes reflect the social conditions of the time and place. Arson and stealing horses were the worst crimes, more heavily punished than murder or mutilation. The penalty was the same for stealing a beaver out of another man's trap, for trespassing on his land, for knocking out his tooth, or for killing his slave. This was a society that put its emphasis on the value of property. There has been some dispute among scholars over whether agriculture was more or less important than commerce in Kievan Russia. Although it is clear that farming played a large role, the emphasis should certainly be put upon trade. In this trade, with Byzantium in particular, the Russians sold mostly furs, honey, and wax, not products of agriculture at all, but of hunting and beekeeping. Since the Byzantines paid in cash, Kiev had much more of a money economy than did Western Europe. Viewed from the economic and social point of view, Kievan Russia was in some ways more advanced than backward manorial Western Europe, where markets, fairs, and industries were only beginning to spring up in Flanders, along the Baltic shore, and in northern Italy. During the period before the Tatar invasions, which began in the early 1200s, this Kievan state began to have close diplomatic and political relations with the West. Dynastic marriages were arranged between the ruling house of Kiev and the royal families of Sweden and France, and alliances were reached with the Holy Roman Empire of Germany. Merchants from the West appeared in Russia, especially at Novgorod in the north, and at Kiev itself. It is then conceivable that whatever handicap was imposed by Byzantine Christianity might have been overcome had Kiev been allowed to maintain its free lines of communications with the West. Its advance might have come through developing further this vigorous and valuable exchange. But as things turned out, Russia was denied this opportunity. The Kievan state had internal political weaknesses, especially the failure to make any rules for the succession to the throne, and the practice of dividing up the land among the prince's sons as if it were the private property of the prince. The fragmentation of the Kievan state into mutually hostile provinces weakened it in the face of outside dangers. Beginning in the 11th century, the Turkish tribe of Polovtsi, or Cumans, appeared on the southern steppes of Russia, just as the Huns had swept into Europe earlier. The Russian princes, warring against one another, made a tragic error by hiring bands of Polovtsi. Thus, when the Mongol Tatars appeared in the early 13th century, Kievan Russia had been softened for the blow. The sole surviving heroic poem of the Kievan period, the Song of the Expedition of Igor, reproves the Russian princes. Voices have grown mute. Revelry has waned. Lower your banners, sheath your damaged swords, for ye have already strayed far from the glory of your grandsire. For with your own treasons ye began to bring the infidels upon the Russian land. For through civil strife came violence from the land of the Polovtsians. Never entirely centralized politically, the Kievan state nonetheless strove for unity. It bequeathed the ideal of unity to the future Russian state that was to emerge after more than two centuries of Mongol domination. The common heritage of a literary language and of a single Christian faith laid the basis for a future unified state. It was this later state, the state of Moscow, that was to take from the Byzantines not only their form of religion, already deeply entrenched in the Russia of Kiev, but also their political theory of autocracy and much of their political practice.